Well, good day to you. It's Joel with The King Country dropping in to let you know that our brand new film, Unsung Hero, is in theaters now.
It's Luke here. We've teamed up with the creators of Jesus Revolution to bring you this adventure of a lifetime. It's a powerful, true story about a family uniting, growing in their faith, and facing the impossible together.
In theaters now, unsunghero.movie for more information.
Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested.
Hi, I'm Dave Barnes.
And I'm John McLaughlin.
And welcome to Dadville.
Dadville is a podcast where we talk about life, love, and the pursuit of awesome dadding.
It's funny thoughts and deep talks.
So please, enjoy your time here in Dadville and enjoy this episode with...
Michael Weir.
Hey everybody, it's Dave here. I've got new music out. That's right, I have a new song called Years Long that just came out that is going to be a part of an album that is coming out in late October. Can't wait to tell y'all more about that. But for now, if you need a slow jam, a little love song for your fall, go check out Years Long. It just came out. You can stream it wherever you like to get your music. I also want to say, I see that Bologna FC back there. Can I get the backstory of that, please?
That's my team. That's my
team. Is it really?
Yeah. I'm a big Serie A guy, but especially Bologna. Got to see them play a few matches, and I think their stadium's iconic. Bologna means a lot. Means a lot to us, yeah.
Now, Dave, how does that make you feel?
Listen, I'm, you know.
Is that okay?
Well, just hold on one second. Let me show you something. This is what's hanging up.
Here we go.
All right.
Dave's holding up an Arsenal
scarf. And we can be
scarf.
Friends because of Serie A and EPL, you know, they yeah. can,
and
they
like,
can exist together.
I don't think Bologna is making the Champions League anytime soon. So the odds of our teams meeting each other
ever crossing
are pretty distant.
I don't know. I mean, I know a couple of friends who are Serie A fans, and I mean literally a couple. One of them is a Roma, and then I've got like a Juventus one or two. But I have never, I didn't know that in my life I thought I would ever cross paths with someone who's like, let me tell you, man.
To me, it's like you guys are just making words up right now.
We are. None of this actually exists.
to give the layman person an idea of your team, Michael, well, both of you guys, what's the NFL team that would be the equivalent of Arsenal and Bologna?
Oh, I want to hear Michael's answer so bad on this.
Cleveland Browns.
Yeah.
Although, like the Browns yesterday, sometimes we surprise people we beat a Juventus or a Roma, but it's a surprise when it happens.
I'd probably say the Cowboys, in that we've had a heyday. And I mean, and you know what? Look at you, Michael. I'm gonna use yesterday as the example too. Last night, you know, they came back and stomped the Giants, and right now Arsenal is back in its ascendancy. So you know, maybe it's
a
storied past with a bright future. Yes. Michael, let me tell you what you didn't come on here to talk about. And that's a Serie A, unless you did. And let's do that because
I feel like we should tell listeners who are about to turn it off, like, hey, this is not a sports episode.
But it can be. Let's not call it yet.
Yeah.
A new branch of my.
Yeah.
Is opening up here. Yeah.
Yeah. It's all going to, you're going to get so many podcast requests because of these first 5 minutes. Okay. So everybody, this is really exciting. We have got Michael Weir on, and we have wanted Michael to be on for a really, really long time.
Yeah.
True story.
We have been throwing your name around for years.
Yeah. It's a true story. Michael, I feel like between John and I, we probably have 100 million mutual friends because I know you have a lot of Nashville people.
Yeah.
So it's really fun having you on. And so this is really cool. And this is by far one of the most unique. We start with what we call the brag sheet, Michael, which is just kind of like, this is your life. Is it who you want to be?
It's my favorite 90s sitcom jingle. Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
So I'm going to read it. Okay, Michael Weir. Currently, Michael is the founder, president, and CEO of the Center for Christianity and Public Life. His next book, which comes out in January, is called The Spirit of Our Politics, Spiritual Formation and Renovation of Public Life. Worked in the White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships during the President Obama's first term. First book was called Reclaiming Hope, Lessons Learned in the Obama White House about the Future of Faith in America. Also writes for The Atlantic, New York Times, Washington Post, Catapult Magazine, Christianity Today, and other publications on faith, politics, and culture. Also provides off-the-record analysis and insight into boards. organizational staff, political and religious leaders. This is really cool. Holds an honorary position at the University of Birmingham. I'm going to say Birmingham because if it was Birmingham, it'd just be Samford. The University of Birmingham's Cadbury Center for the Public of Understanding of Religion, and has lives in Maryland, as we say down here, with two daughters. And you got to tell me, these are the most beautiful names ever, and I'm terrified to mispronounce them.
Saoirse and Ilaria. Yeah.
Look at
Saoirse and Ilaria. What's the story with those names? Are those family names?
No, so Saoirse,
two of Bologna's most infamous strikers. Well,
so my youngest, her middle name is Ciro, and she's named after my grandfather, but it's not a coincidence that Ciro Immobile is also a Ciro. Saoirse, we just fell in love with the name. We do have some like Irish, but really we just fell in love with the name. It means freedom. My wife worked for the British, and so she worked with a number of Saoirses in her time, and just always loved the name. And then Ilaria, we were in Italy, and I was ordering from like a casual like fast food Italian seafood joint, and the waitress who took my order said her name, and I was like, I'm sorry, what was that? And like she said it again, and I walked out of the restaurant and told my wife, if we have a second girl, this is the name. And thankfully my wife agreed. And yeah, we just, it's the Italian form of Hillary.
Gotcha.
And so it means cheerful. And
oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's really, really pretty.
That's great.
And beats basically every other two kids' names I've ever heard before. And I loved
Thank you.
It.
Right.
Well, we figured after we started with Saoirse, like we couldn't go.
You can't go with Becky or something.
Yeah. Yeah. There would be a real imbalance there. So, you know, minimum of three vowels.
That's right. And some backstory. Like you need an origin story with both names at that point.
Yeah,
can't be like, you know, it's my great aunt from, you know, Kalamazoo.
That's right.
So one of the reasons that we've been so excited to have you on is you work in a space that, I mean, you know, John and I living in Nashville playing music professionally. I mean, I just don't, for as much as I cross paths with people, I just don't cross paths with people in politics. And that's not because I purposefully don't or like I have some beef. It's just that, you know, it just feels like that's just not circles I'm in much. And so one of the things that I kind of want to come off the top with, just right off the top rope, is I'd love to, my question is for you, like, if I'm being honest, it's not something that I think about much, right? Like, I live my life, we have our kids, we do sports, I do my job, you know, I'm just doing, you know, we're doing our thing. And when I interact with politics, I tend to be like, oh man, that's a lot of stuff I don't know about. And I would say maybe most importantly, Michael, I'm like, what good can I do? Right? Like little me. And so I think just initially that's sort of what I would posit to you. It's sort of like how, for those who are listening, and I bet a lot of people listening, we have listeners in the millions, is like, you know, for all the 100 million, is it 100 million, John? 200
it's
million.
It's hundreds or millions. Or
hundreds or millions of listeners. You know, that maybe
we
feel...
take a five-minute break. I need to gird myself. Yeah, this is...
Get ready, because you really need, you're going to be accountable for what you say. It could change nations. It's just like, you know... What would you say to people like me, and again, who I imagine a lot of listeners are, who just don't even really think about this? Yeah. You know, it's just like, it's too far. It's too much to do. It's like, and again, what good can I do with that? Like, what would you say to that?
Yeah. So as a citizen in this country, you do not choose to have political influence. You already have it. Mm-hmm. And you are already making choices about how to steward that responsibility now, right? Like we should right size that every citizen has responsibility, but because we live in such a huge nation and people have different callings, that responsibility, you know, you don't bear all the responsibility for how everything goes, especially not how everything turns out. But I would encourage folks to think about the fact that as you know, there are so many areas of our lives in which we do dedicate and choose to dedicate a portion of our time, our attention, our resources, for which that's responsibility that we you know, choose ourselves. But our civic life is one where just by the fact of being here, we have that responsibility. Politics, I know politics has become about so much more than what it should be, mm-hmm. right? Like when you think about, well, what is politics? Like, self-governance is like at best like eighth on the list. You think, well, it's where like a bunch of people argue about esoteric sort of things that no one really knows anything about, and you know, you could go down the list. It's why we can't keep a Thanksgiving dinner, you know, together. All those kinds of things. But at its heart, and what politics is supposed to be about is just like how we organize the lives and the governance of our communities. And so if we care about our neighbors, if we will the good for our neighbors, and our own families and the institutions in which so you mentioned sports, you mentioned, you know, your family, you mentioned schools. Well, all those things are affected by political decisions. They're not entirely mm-hmm. determined by them, but they're affected by them. You know, so we have a responsibility there. So that would be the base level argument that political decisions affect the well-being of our neighbors, the communities in which we play a role. And so to dedicate some portion of our attention and our resources is a way to be faithful with the influence that we've been given.
Yeah.
So Dave, I feel like if we can generalize listeners into maybe two categories. Dave, you're talking about the people who maybe just don't think about it much. And then maybe there's another category of people who think about it, but just get overwhelmed because mm-hmm. it seems like to be an informed voter, it'd be a full-time job. Like if you go to the ballot and you're looking at all these issues, aside from the people that you're, you know, you want to know a little bit about each person and you want to think locally as well as federally, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's so overwhelming. I feel like a lot of times when we're having discussions or arguments or whatever, a lot of times we're citing the headlines of the articles we didn't read. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Which is all understandable because we don't work in politics. We all have got kids and lives and all that kind of stuff. Are there one or two pieces of advice that you would have for listeners like that who want to like have some kind of manageable way to educate themselves?
Yeah. So the first is like, right, like not even like there's a reason why we have why like Congress has committees, and it's because the members on those committees are supposed to specialize, focus on those issues, and they typically don't know definitely as much and sometimes not much at all about other areas of interest. So even elected officials where that's their job have specialization and areas of focus. And if there are votes that they need to take that implicate a whole bunch of issues, but their passion is one slice of it, they will often weight that thing that they care about heavier, even if sort of that isn't a reflection of reality. So voters just folks who don't have a political vocation certainly have the freedom to do that. So that would be the first thing, like just relieve yourself of the burden to feel like you need to know everything, the burden to feel like, oh gosh, you know, I have this instinct. I think this is the right position to hold, the right candidate to vote for. But what if I turn out to be wrong, you know, then I'm sort of on the hook for something that I could have just, you know, stepped back from.
Yeah. You don't want to be on the wrong side of history. So you just stay out of the fight.
Right. Yeah. And you know, we have to be responsible for the things that we say, the things that we do, but I would just argue that in the political realm, that is tempered by the fact that no one really knows what's going to be the result of these. We're all just trying to do our best. So my basic level encouragement to folks would be do your best. I have a 2 and a 4-year-old. If I wasn't working in politics, I would be dedicating this would be a season where, even though I have civic commitments and that's really important to me, this would be a season of my life in which I would be reading much less news, where I would be attending far fewer sort of meetings. And folks have the freedom to be like seasonal and to think about where it fits in their life as it is now. And that may be different in the future or than they've, you know, previously been engaged. And so, yeah, that would be my think about your life. Think about the challenges that you see facing your own family, the challenges that you see in your community. And, you know, think about, well, you know, I have a, my family was on food stamps growing up. I'm really attentive to what nutrition programs for the government look like. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I have kids who are about to head in school. I'm going to pay particular attention to public education in this season of my life. And so those are the, you don't need to be an expert in everything. And that's not what being a citizen is about. The whole point of self-governance is that everyone's able to sort of contribute without having the burden of being a sole decision maker.
So he gets off the, He gets off the roller coaster, stumbles left, stumbles right, spots a trash can, and boom, buries his head in it and gets sick. Unbelievable. And that was the same day I met your grandma, John. Isn't that weird?
Such a small world.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so what happened after he got out of the trash can?
Well, he kept riding more coasters, and he got sick about four more times. And it was at that moment I thought, I wish I could have helped him. And then you told me about today's sponsor.
That is right, Dave. Dadville is sponsored by Relief Band. I thought we were going to say it together.
No, Relief Band.
Let's do it one more time.
Okay.
Relief Band. That's nice. Yeah. Have you ever had to pull over because someone in the car was sick?
Oh, man.
All the time.
Yep.
Or maybe someone in your family had to miss school or work because they were nauseous.
If that sounds familiar, you need Relief Band. Relief Band is the number one FDA-cleared anti-nausea wristband that has been clinically proven to quickly relieve and effectively prevent nausea and vomiting associated with motion sickness, anxiety, migraines, hangovers, morning sickness, chemotherapy, and so much more.
I love Relief Band because whenever one of the girls starts to get a little car sick, we give them a Relief Band and the nausea, boom, goes away. It sounds like that when it leaves.
Yeah.
Like
well.
Yeah. She feels so much better. We don't take a road trip without it, Dave, and we always have it ready to go at home.
Hmm. In case I wasn't clear, okay, I'm just going to circle back. Relief Band is legitimately a band you wear on your wrist to give you relief from nausea and uses technology that works with your body, so it's safe, drug-free, and has zero side effects. It's just that simple.
Plus, Relief Band both treats and prevents nausea, so you can help stop nausea from becoming a problem in the first place. It's a must-have for every road trip.
Remember, you don't have to overplan for nausea relief or dose up 6 hours before a trip. Just bring your Relief Band and you are good to go. Right now, we've got an exclusive offer just for Dadville listeners.
If you go to reliefband.com and use the promo code Dadville, you will receive, Dave, what do you think?
2% off.
And that would be great, right?
Yeah.
And then add a zero.
No, what about 2% and double the shipping? Is that what they do?
Let me tell you what they do. Okay. They added a zero to that. That's 20% off plus, Dave, free shipping.
What?
They're covering all the shipping.
How does this business do?
I know
business?
It. So head to Relief Band, ReliefBand.com, and use your promo code Dadville for 20% off plus free shipping. Dadville is sponsored by BetterHelp.
John, have you ever had a time in your life where you felt like you knew it was good for you, but your brain was just getting in the way?
I know exactly what you mean. I remember this time when I kept thinking, this is what I should be doing. I know this is what's best for me and my family, but something is holding me back.
Yep, been there too. I think most of us probably have. And one great way to make those difficult thoughts go away is to talk them through. Therapy gives you a place to do that so you can get out of your negative thought cycles and start improving.
You could not be more right, Dave. And most of the time, you're right. I'll just say it. Therapy is so helpful. It teaches coping skills, helps you set boundaries, empowers you to be the best version of yourself.
If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge.
Get a break from your thoughts with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Dadville today to get 10% off your first month.
That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Dadville.
Yeah, and sure. I think that's good because this reminds me of advice that somebody gave me on like investing money. And they said that don't invest in things that you don't know anything about. Mm-hmm. So like if you love whatever, if you're a car guy or whatever, like and maybe invest in auto stuff. I sound so dumb when I just said that. Auto stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
Follow.
How many stocks, how many shares of GM do you own?
So many auto stuff.
Yeah,
stuff.
So.
Gosh, just.
So many.
But yeah, I think it's stuff. That same idea, though. Like, follow the things that apply to your life because that's probably more sustainable because it actually interests you and affects your life directly. And don't feel guilty about some other issue that you don't know anything about. And feel like you need to take the time to go and research it necessarily.
Yeah.
I think the thing that's so tricky though is it still feels like this is me just speaking really candidly. It just feels so overwhelming. And again, it's like what is especially for the time, it's sort of a time thing. It's like for the time you put in, your one vote.
Mm-hmm.
Like one vote. And do not get me wrong, I'm thankful for that one vote. And Annie and I both vote. Like we are participants in that. But you know what I mean? I'm like,
yes.
Okay, yeah. For all the time I'm going to invest sort of figuring out the issues on things, you know, I go place the one vote and then it's like, you know, and because to your point, Michael, the country is massive, you know, and our state is massive, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, is it really going to matter that one vote, you know, like that one that I even vote, but two that I vote in some, you know, certain capacity. And I mean, it does it somewhat become more of a... ideological stance, you know, where like it's just good to do it, so you should do it? Or do you feel like these things still really matter in a country that's this enormous?
You know, a couple layers to that. So yes, it does still matter. You know, we still have, especially at the local level, you know, elections are decided by 80 votes, you know, a couple hundred mm-hmm. votes. So the act of voting does matter. To zoom out like a bit from voting, you know, voting itself. I have seen in my work, in my life in politics, individuals make a profound difference. Mm-hmm. I tell a story in my first book, and I know y'all had a Stanfill on. I was a White House staffer in January of 2012. I was briefing a senior advisor to the president, and we had talked about a number of issues. And on my way out, the senior advisor goes, you know, Michael, we've talked about a lot. If there was one thing that we should focus on, what should it be? And I had in my binder a printout of a CNN article about the Passion Conference in January 2012. It was the first time Passion had focused specifically on an issue, on a social issue, and they raised $3 million to combat human trafficking that year at Passion. 60,000 college students packed out the Georgia Dome. And so I took out this article, showed the senior advisor, and I said, for young Christians around this country, this is a rights issue of our time. And I recount in the book how the machinery of government responded to that. Now, it wasn't just that. There were other people doing other work and there was a confluence of things. But I could draw a direct line from 60,000 college students who had no idea that anybody but God was watching them. But there was someone in the White House who was paying attention. That person told others about it. And within a year, the president of the United States was given a speech at the Clinton Global Initiative that resulted in hundreds of millions of dollars of additional American investment in combating human trafficking. It was the longest speech on slavery that an American president has given since Abraham Lincoln. And I could draw a direct line from those 60,000 Christians in the Georgia Dome to that moment. And I have just like countless stories like that. And so making a difference is possible. I do think politics is especially for younger folks and like just like 40 and under, like those in like the digital era and sophistication of technology, the idea that so much of our lives right now, like if we want to invest, the example I use is charity water, right? Like if you give $50 to charity water, the team over there will send you a GPS, and you could, if you want, you could watch the live webcam feed of the well that you helped build with your $50 contribution. And right, the whole point of that is to, you're getting an immediate sort of reward for what you contributed. And you could say, I did that. Our politics offers very few opportunities for you to say, I did that. You could write, you could write a letter to your congressman, congressperson, and maybe they vote the way you wanted them to. But you're kind of like, it's very rare that you'll get a response. I'm voting because you wrote this letter. It's like, well, right. I hope I made a difference, but I don't really know. And so I think that like the fact that we don't get the dopamine hit from actual political participation is a real problem. The last thing I'd say on this, though, is so part of what you see happening is because there isn't the dopamine hit from actual political participation, you have a lot of people going to politics as a form of entertainment. And that will give you a dopamine hit. So if the dopamine hit of, if you're not getting the dopamine hit from attending a school board meeting, which is actual sort of political participation, but you are getting a dopamine hit from tweeting the vulgarity at the school, at the head of the school board for not doing something that you want them to do, that's where a lot of the political energy is going. And what I'd say is that A, that's very destructive. B, Christians have resources to draw on that should allow us to not need to go to politics for that, for those kinds of emotional, you know, incentives, and instead go to politics for its limited but important, you know, purposes.
Just to back up for a second, you so just quickly breezed through earlier that while you were working in the White House, and you know, Dave, that's just another day in my life. That's just a piece of my history that's as common as the Whataburger I had 2 days ago. Like, John and I were talking about this before the thing. What in the world is that like? Like, when you were working in the White House. So, were you there for 4 years?
Three and a half.
Yeah. Okay. What in the world? I'm just going to say it again. What in the world is that like?
Well, it was an incredible honor. You know, I think a lot of people expect, oh, like you saw how the sausage was made. You must have stories to tell about, you know, leaders not being who they said they were. And I think it was, you know, so I was helped by the fact that I was in the faith-based office. So I think if I was maybe somewhere else, maybe I would have had a different experience. But I got to say, like, I left government feeling much more optimistic, hopeful about Christian leadership in this country, about the future of the country than I was when I got in, because so much of my job was like working with, well, first of all, I've never been more prayed for than the 3.5 years I was in the role. Second, I just got to work with Christians on the ground and other folks, but I just got to see like the best of the church. I got to see people who were spending day after day trying to serve those in need. I got to meet people who had sincere motivation, who believed that their faith motivated them to care for others. And it was just like, it was an incredible experience. And working in the White House, this is a trope, but you know, it is, you know, like a living museum. You know, you just walk around and just go, oh yeah, that's where, you know, Nixon did his farewell speech, and oh, this is where Kennedy gave the speech in the Rose Garden. And you know, like it is a surreal kind of experience.
Was there temptations to steal stuff?
Yeah, I mean, temptations. Let me show you my China collection. Yeah. I mean, I was able to make it out with Truman and Ford.
That is like, you know, to John's reaction too, I'm like, I just can't imagine when you're in a place with the history that that has, where like every nook and cranny has some significance, has some piece of history.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is where you are for 3.5 years. Like, I just, that, which, you know, I think one of the things that we know about humans is we all get used to everything, right? Yeah. It doesn't, like, you know, that's why people who live in Utah, I'm like, how do you not walk out your front door and see those mountains? And like, right, yeah, it's the mountains, right. You know what I mean? But still, to be there for such a short time has to inform some sense of like wherewithal, because you know you know there's a time, you know, from how long you're going to be in there. Do you have any, like, is there any moment from that that was just like, oh my gosh, it's the coolest thing in the world, like Bono just, you know, like peed where Gerald Ford peed?
Yeah, right.
That same corner.
Yeah, exactly. that same flower pot. I got to hear Sarah Groves perform. He's always been faithful to me at a conference. And I knew that we needed to have her. And Sarah's a friend. And so the president held Easter prayer breakfast. And it was like, this event was amazing. It doesn't happen anymore. But it was like in the weeks surrounding Easter, you'd have like the heads of denomination, like Christian leaders from around the country. And it would be like and this is a commentary. We could take this conversation on a whole other path, which is, it did strike me as a believer, you know, why can't we do this on our own? Like, why does it take the president to bring all these various people together? Mm-hmm. But you would have the head of the Southern Baptist Convention sitting at a table with the head of the Episcopal Church. I mean, like, you're just not going to. And then you have like the president's cabinet, secretary of defense, heads of military branches, secretary of transportation, like senior White House staff. And there's a worship service. So there would be a sermon, there would be scripture reading. We had Sarah Groves. Carlos Whitaker.
He did it my last
year when I was there. But Sarah came and she sang, He's Always Been Faithful to Me. And, I didn't know she was going to do this, but she comes to the end and she goes, I wonder if we might sing Great is Thy Faithfulness. And, you know, it takes some real like fortitude to just call like an audible like that in a setting like that. But Sarah felt led, and everyone stood up, and you see, like, again, like Secretary of Defense with, like, you know, some, like, you know, Quaker leader, you know, like whatever, like you just look around the room and 180 people are singing Great is Thy Faithfulness in the East Room of the White House. Jeez. I'll like never ever forget that and always be grateful that Sarah sort of brought in that moment.
That's cool.
Right.
It'd be funny if you were like, she called an audible, let's sing Great is Thy Faithfulness. She was immediately tackled by seven.
Yes, that's right.
Service agents.
Yeah, she twitches. If you see her twitch, she got that taser.
But she's now got two more notes on a range at the top, which is really worth all of it.
Okay, so I have a question bolded here in my notes, because I told Dave if I only had time to ask one question, this is it. I thought it was two questions. As I'm skimming through it now, I'm like, this is kind of like a two-part question. So it's basically, I want to talk about the separation of church and state.
Yeah.
Right. And you are such a unique person to talk to about this, because this is the water you swim in, you know. And in my, I also want to draw attention to what you said earlier, where you were talking about young people, and you said anyone 40 and younger. So I just want to make note for the record that I am in that category, and Dave is in more of the elder category. But the separation of church and state, I feel like, to me, in my short 40 years, I think that this is just a concept that I am supposed to wrestle with. You know, I don't know, like maybe many other issues, I'm not sure if it's something where we're supposed to land on it and that's our stance and then we stay there till we leave this earth or whatever.
Yeah.
And because I don't feel like we should be forcing prayer in public schools, right? And I don't want my pastor on Sunday morning to get up and in his sermon tell me who he thinks we should be voting for in the next election. But at the same time, I don't think our elected officials who are believers should leave their faith at home when they go to work. You know
yes.
what I mean?
Yes.
And so as someone who is founder, president, CEO of an organization called the Center for Christianity and Public Life, I'm curious what your thoughts are, this first part of the question, on just the separation of church and state.
Yeah. So so I write about this in my upcoming book that will be out in January, and I'm interested to see what people think about it. So I think the separation of church and state as a legal concept is valid. And I think that there are mm-hmm. other situations and other contexts that, like, I don't think it's something that has to transfer to every time and context as like this ultimate ideal, but I think it's viable. I think it can be consistent with a Christian, with Christian faithfulness. What I'm concerned about is the other work outside of strict legal and sort of political application that the separation of church tends to do, like the philosophical message it sends. And there are a number of stories I could tell here. A couple. I was sitting down with the leader in philanthropy. So not government, private philanthropy. And this philanthropic organization was doing work on poverty, on housing, on education. And I was talking about all the work that faith-based organizations do. And by the way, I wasn't working for government at the time. This is after. And I was talking through all the work that faith-based organizations and churches contribute to those kinds of issues, which are right in her wheelhouse. It's her mission. Mm-hmm. And she goes, I finish and she goes to me, Michael, you know, it's interesting. I'm glad for that work, but because of this, the separation of church and state, we don't fund religious organizations. And I just said, referring to church and state, I said, well, which one are you? She's not either. There's this idea, sort of the philosophical message that separation of church and state seems to send, or at least the way people take it on, is that faith isn't up to the task of real life. It's not up to the task of real decisions that deal with reality. Right. So Dallas Willard, when he was contemplating the idea of a secular university, he asked the question, is reality secular? And who made that determination and on what basis? And if we haven't made that determination, then what does it mean to say that you're a secular university? Maybe you're not the one dealing in reality as it is. And so, again, I think, Willard wrote that the separation of church and state should be zealously upheld as a legal principle. But I think as Christians, and what that means, so right, a strict reading of the separation of church and state means you can't make affiliation with a particular denomination a prerequisite for holding office. You can't have the government making an official church religion. So like the British system would not be consistent with the separation of church and state. The Church of England is the official denomination faith of Britain. And that would cross the line. What doesn't cross the line is people of faith and various faiths, those of none at all, bringing their conception of reality, their conception of their own priorities to their political decision making. And I would argue that's what democracy requires. If we're telling people, there's all this sort of like expressive language in our make your voice heard, stand up for what you believe. We can't say that. And then say, unless your beliefs are informed by your faith or your positions are informed by your faith, then you need to leave those to the side. And so that's the tension.
you asking about my friend? His name is John. If you're asking about his last name, it's McLaughlin.
And his friend's name's Dave.
Oh, we changed keys. I'm fine with that. Okay. Lately, John, you one of the first things you said when you came in, you said, hey, what have you been about lately? Do you remember when you said that a second ago?
Word for word what I said.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to answer that word for word. Lately, I've been all about Rooted, the NIV Bible for Men. I simply can't put it down. Have you seen it?
Tell, Dave. I could see it in your face. And Dave, I love it too. New from Zondervan Bible Publishers, designed to help you connect with your identity in Christ, is Rooted, the NIV Bible for Men and Dave.
What?
And Flourish, the NIV Bible for Women.
Yeah.
Dave, let me ask you something. Yeah. What is so awesome about Rooted?
John,
tell me.
You know me. I can be a little scattered at times, okay? No, I can say that. Don't say it. It hurts too much. Yeah. So I love the summary of talking points and questions at the beginning of each book of the Bible. It helps center my focus about what I'm about to read and what to look for.
You know, another cool thing is the profiles that it has on certain people in the Bible. Rooted goes a little more in depth about important figures and the roles that they played.
Other features include myth articles that expose commonly accepted myths of our culture and refute them with God's word. It has notes that offer clarity into the attributes of God and has questions for growth that you can answer alone, with a friend, or in a small group.
You know, both of these Bibles, Flourish for Women and Rooted for Men, offer the knowledge, strength, and clarity to navigate life's challenges with Scripture as your guide.
And Flourish, the NIV Bible for Women, and Rooted, the NIV Bible for Men, are available both in hardcover and leather soft styles.
Find out more and order your copy today at amazon.com/rootedandflourish.
That's amazon.com/rootedandflourish. Okay. John, right? I see your point.
Okay.
But even though technically the Roman Empire began in 625 BC, it didn't really make significant progress until the period of kings in the 500s.
Here we go. So what, you think that they became an empire then just because they were selling oil lamps everywhere?
Mm.
Dave, please, unification over invasion had united the people and forged a spirit long before the period of kings.
Come on, John. How can you be this dense? What does Amy say about this, huh? Surely she can talk some sense in you. This is incredible.
No, Amy believes that the Roman Empire... Wait a minute. Actually, I don't think Amy has ever shared any of her thoughts about the Roman Empire.
Oh.
Which is crazy. We've been together for so long. Yeah. How have I never talked about this with her?
Yeah.
Dave?
Yeah, I feel like I need a break too. Let's just get some coffee.
Wait, did you just say coffee?
Yeah.
Well, today's episode and my morning cup of Joe is brought to you by Dave, let's sing it together. This is a word that's so special. I don't say it. I sing it.
Methodical coffee. Oh, shoot. Okay.
No, that's fine. You nailed it.
Methodical Coffee has craft coffee and tea for people of all kinds. Roasted, blended, brewed, served, and perfected. Now, those are the coffees, not the people, but could be the people. Perfected by verified coffee and tea nerds like my friend Johnny John John.
Oh, that's exactly right. And Methodical isn't just the name of their business, Dave. I can't say this enough. It's their approach to everything.
Everything.
Methodical's been roasting and hosting, R&H. Which rhymes, so we like that as songwriters, for over 8 years and offers a wide selection of coffees and teas that are complex yet easygoing, like my buddy Dave Barnes.
Don't do that. But the best of Methodical's coffees is our signature Dadville blend.
Dave, the Dadville blend is the fuel that gets me going every morning.
I love that.
Filled with hints of chocolate, graham, and brown sugar.
And if you go to methodicalcoffee.com/Dadville, it takes you right to the Dadville signature blend. And don't forget to enter our discount code, Dadville.
Visit methodicalcoffee.com for more information and use the discount code Dadville for 10% off your first order. That's methodicalcoffee.com and use the discount code Dadville.
Man,
Dave, I want to give a shout out. And when I give a shout out, I always laugh because it just brings me so much joy to give a shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with free samples.
You know it, John. This time of year, my allergies are in fuego. They're always on the attack, but I use this and you should too.
Oh, I do, Dave. every day in our house. Yeah. Luckily, for those of us who live with the symptoms of allergies, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D.
Designed for serious allergy sufferers, which is, me raising my hand, Claritin D has two powerful ingredients in just one pill to relieve your allergy symptoms and decongest your nose so you can breathe better.
This double-action combination of prescription-strength allergy medicine and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing, runny nose, itchy and watery eyes, and itchy nose and throat and sinus congestion and pressure with ease.
John, I've been taking Claritin D for my allergies for a long time, and it's been an absolute life changer. I can go for a run without my eyes watering. I may be crying, but it's not
sure,
from allergies.
Totally different.
And I can sing without feeling like I have like a big old, let's say we call it a frog. It's like a toad.
It's like a family of toads.
It's a family. It's a turtle.
Yeah.
In my throat.
So you ready to live life as if you don't have allergies?
Yeah, me.
It's time to live Claritin Clear. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. Find Claritin D at the pharmacy counter.
Ask for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter. You don't even need a prescription. Go to Claritin.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin Clear. Use as directed.
Well, and it's like as a Christian boater, right? You have... It's like if I can generalize it this way, like my faith is like my beliefs, my ideals on any given part of life, right? And then the political side feels more like my views and compromise.
Yeah, right.
So like the example to go back to the prayer in school thing, if I could make everyone on this planet as a Christian, if I could have everyone instantly know the love of Christ by cutting my pinky off, I would immediately cut my pinky off.
Yeah.
Right. But at the same time, I like I said earlier, I don't support sanctioned prayer in public schools. I don't think that's a good idea. Not everyone is a believer. Some people in that classroom have different faith systems. Like just because it's my religion, I don't think we should put one religion on everybody. So it's like my faith encompasses all of this, but as a voter, it's like I have to draw the line somewhere for myself, which is tricky. And it was interesting. I was excited to talk to you about this because this is the water you swim in, you know, just those two elements that can be like oil and water sometimes, that's your world, you know.
So I just encourage you. And right, like to discern this, but my sense of what you just said is not, I'm putting my faith to the side when I say that I don't think school should enforce prayer. No, that's a faithful decision about in a particular context.
Right.
This is how you're applying your beliefs and what you think, like, I think the idea of coercion and faith is one that we don't need to go outside of scripture to resource. I think there's significant scriptural resources for why you wouldn't force people to proclaim something they don't believe. And so that would be, I think that there are many faithful ways to approach politics. I think that you could vote. I think that two Christians could vote on the opposite sides of an issue and be equally faithful.
Yeah.
What I am always looking for is what is the logic path that they take to get there. I'm looking for I think Jesus would have this, but, you know, is that really safe? You know, is that, don't we really need to get practical here? And that's when I want to, not as a political matter, but as like a pastoral matter, do you believe Jesus is Lord? What else don't you trust Jesus with in your life? And what I found is like, when people make these sorts of separations in politics, they're making them in their own lives. So when they face financial pressure with their home finances, they say, well, generally, Jesus would have me be honest with my accounting and with how I'm paying my taxes. But the pressure is on. And if I don't fudge the numbers a bit, I don't know if we're going to make it. So I don't know if Jesus is really up to the task of me making my life work. And people make those kinds of judgments in politics all the time. And it's not, well, this is a different area of life and we live in a pluralistic society. It's no, I just don't trust what I think Jesus would have me do in this situation. And that's the thing I'm concerned about. I'm less concerned about sort of, well, I think the minimum wage should be this and I think it should be that. No, there's a range of faithful Christian positions on those kinds of issues.
Yeah.
God, that is really well articulated. It is interesting to have to hold that thing, that it's that dual thing where you're like, you know, you really can have two amazing people of faith disagree on something. And I think that takes a lot of maturity to have. But you said it well. It's more about, well, let's talk about how you get to where that is, because you may really have a conviction and that's great. And then this person over here can have a conviction. But man, when the asterisks start to fly in is where it gets a little like, uh-oh.
Yeah.
You know, like, okay, this is where it breaks down a little bit. Yeah.
No, I think it's right. And the kind of people we are has much to do with the kind of politics that we have. And I think Christians need to be much more attentive to how and the spirit with which they're approaching their politics than thinking that the faith is synonymous with one particular ideological approach.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
What we have a lot of is folks justifying so much. Not really they might invoke the faith, but really it's in the name of a policy agenda, an ideological agenda. Mm-hmm. And what gets put to the side is the spirit with which they're conducting themselves. And I would rather have folks that I might disagree with prudentially, but are carrying themselves with the fruit of the spirit.
Yes.
Than folks who are belligerently advancing because they think the ends justify the means, some particular approach through means that actually undermine folks' confidence in their end too. Like it usually doesn't work out that well. So
That's great. Okay. So a couple more questions. One of the things I really like this as a thought. So let's say over the next 10 years, everything you're pushing for, right?
Yeah.
Goes your way. And we get back together, let's say in 10 years, you know, September 2033. What would that look like if you're like, man, all of my hopes and dreams for this is probably a dangerous game to play because you're going to immediately start crying because, you know, that's such a far-fetched idea. But like, what would it look like? Like, what would we be talking about and celebrating?
Yeah, there is. So the mission of the Center for Christianity and Public Life is to contend for the credibility of Christian resources in public life for the public good. And there's this survey question that's been asked over the course of decades. And the question is, do you believe religion is part of the solution to America's problems or part of the problem itself? That's basically the question. And up until 20 years ago, that was like an 80-20 question. 80% of Americans would say it's part of the solution. Now, of course, they'd have different opinions about how it's part of the solution. But like the general idea was, if we had more and better religious practice, religious conviction in this country, we'd be in a better place. That is now a 50-50 question. And like the trend line is not positive right now. The political, social, missional, evangelistic consequences of that trend continuing are really profound. It's just a whole different environment to try to be preaching the gospel, to be Christian artists, musicians, to be trying to live out your faith locally in your community. If a majority of people around you think, when asked like the baseline question, are Christians, is religion providing a net positive Or is it part of the problem? Like, that's a whole different environment. So 10 years from now, I think we'd start to see a reversal of that trend line. We'd see Americans, regardless of their faith background, start to regain confidence, not in all people who call themselves to be Christian, but in the idea that if we had better and more positive religious contribution, that our nation would be in a better place. So that's one way of answering the 10-year question. I think the other thing, I think Christians would be at the vanguard of restoring the idea that politics and public life is for service, not for self-aggrandizement, not for entertainment, but for service. And that would both give politics a renewed dignity, and it would also reduce the sort of ultimacy that we've given politics. It would at the same time make it less and more important. And that's what I'd like to see.
That's, you know, it's funny, we've been studying Church Daniel, and man, the application of that to what you're saying, I mean, it's, I've been listening not only to our pastors preach through it, but I've been going to like the Bible Project and, you know, getting all this. And it has just bowled me over how applicable it is to a million things. But really what you just said, this idea that when you see that God brings them in, they assimilate in so many ways.
Yes.
Because it's to better Babylon, which at first you're like, I don't think that's right. You didn't read that right. No, we read it. Like, this whole thing is so that they will contribute to society.
Yes.
That they will renew society through their beliefs and through what God is doing in their lives. And so it's so fascinating to hear you say that, because that's exactly what's happening there. This idea that, like, as believers, we can be in but not of, which you hear a lot and gets really buzzy. But it's true. Like, we participate in politics, in school, and community, in our churches, and our private life, in a way that it renews the earth and people and communities and societies, and, you know, but still doing what we've been called to do, not in this sort of like we carry our banner in and beat the crud out of people with it, but just in these simple, beautiful ways, it just gets better because God's way is better.
Yes.
And if we believe it has a way of renewing these things, you know, it's really powerful. It's really powerful. You know,
it is. And look, I think, I don't know what the trajectory of American politics, American life. You know, I think a lot of us now are reading this book, The Great Dechurching, and that's provided a lot of data on drops of church attendance, religious affiliation in this country. And so there, I care a lot about the overall public trajectory of the country, and that's important. But what I'll say is, So at the nonprofit, at the Center for Christianity and Public Life, we say and believe, it's at the core of what we do, that spiritual formation is central to civic renewal. That actually the public is not going to get better unless we are a different kind of people. And that could, maybe it translates, maybe it doesn't, but at least Christian confidence and Christian resources will be restored. Like we spend so much time looking out and saying, if only people knew more scripture, and, you know, the public folks, secular, quote unquote, secular leaders gave Christians more respect, we'd be in a better place. But I'll just be honest, like, I see a crisis of confidence in the church.
Yeah, that's a great word.
That Christian resources hold up in public life, and if we can't address that, then how can we expect the broader public to think about those things?
God, that's good. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah. So there's a random video that from 2007, 2008, or something like that, that I think about all the time in the last 3-4 years or so. It was John McCain was doing a town hall, and he got a question from a woman who came up and was speaking disparagingly of Obama, and he kind of takes the mic from her and says, "Look, you don't need to be worried about Obama being your president.
Yeah.
I'm running because I think I would be a heck of a lot better president, but you don't need to worry about, you know, he's like, I know him, I know his family. Like, you don't need to be worried. And that video, I think about it so much. Forget about, for those listening, I'm not making a statement about Obama or McCain. I'm not making a political statement at all. What I long for when I think of that video is an open-mindedness that we as a nation, I feel like, have lost we've even lost the idea that we could be open to it. You know what I mean? Yes. But I'm curious, as someone who works in politics, when I bring up that video, are you thinking, no, that happened, examples like that happen all the time? It's just not profitable for media outlets to show you that. That's what I want the answer to be. But what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, this is such a big part of the new book. I talk specifically about this, but really it's right. The striking thing about that video is that he initially gets booed. Mm-hmm. Like it says something, and this is back, like you said, in 2008. It says something about people's state of mind, that when a politician tells them you don't need to be afraid, they boo, you know, like that, I think about that a lot. And we see that in, you know, everyone complains about negative ads, advertising in politics. And I think politicians, people who make ads need to be, they're primarily responsible for what they put out. But what you'll hear when you talk to the people who make these ads is, look, we put out positive ads and the engagement rate was like a flat line. We put out ads about our opponent and a controversy, something that looks like it could be on E! News, and people love it. It drives up our name identification. It drives down our opponent's approval rating. And so we're responding. And again, I don't think this excuses it, but you have to understand, when you read these on the record quotes in places like the New York Times, people saying that I quote in my book, there's a strategist who says, you know, flat out says the algorithm does not reward civility and kindness. and what's it? I wish that she hadn't said algorithm, because the truth of what she's really saying is the people don't reward it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And unless this is the burden and the potential of a democratic system of government, it will, at the end of the day, yes, we could ask for and even demand sort of moments of courage from politicians. And sometimes they could get away with that and stay in office. But if elected officials are standing up to the people who put them in office over and over and over again, they won't be in office that much longer. And so that's an us problem.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I do think there are good people serving. I do think, I mean, the depressing thing is how often you'll hear from politicians themselves say, I wish that I could show kindness publicly to someone across the aisle, but my people would kill me for it.
Right.
You know? And that is just like a really sad, sad thing. I don't know if you saw, you know, one of the recent Republican debates, you know, Chris Christie was getting attacked because when his state got hit by a hurricane, he had the gall to invite the sitting president, who happened to be of another party, to his state. And people were like, you know, this the fact that he hugged the president who was coming to deliver aid so that his people would survive, that he gave him a hug. That's something that partisans are talking about a dozen years after the fact. Like, you know, how could you? You really, like, you know, you shouldn't have given him that legitimacy. And it happens the other side too. And it's just not we need to take responsibility for that.
In the age of the internet and social media is helping that negative 1,000.
Yes.
Yeah. Because we are training our brain. It's like you said, John, we're just training our brains for this clickbait kind of stuff that doesn't honor kindness near as much as it does all the other things that are so, you know, scandalous or like, and to your point too, Michael, that dopamine hit you're going to get every time from those terrible things where, you know, seeing a guy hug another, you know, competitor or whatever. Yeah, it's just like, and I think too, I wonder sometimes, this is neither here nor there, but I do wonder sometimes if we also tell ourselves in those moments, like, we need a fighter, not a nice guy, you know? So it also gets into what we think of leadership and what qualities we believe innately leaders should have. And I think it's, you know, like, thank God Christendom believes this, but, you know, it's hard to convince the world, like, you need kindness and empathy and, you know, hospitality and the fruit of the spirit. Instead, you need, like, you know, Thunder God Jones, who's going to reign from on high with all of his anger and, you know.
Thunder God Jones.
I have something crazy to tell y'all, and I don't know if I'm, but I think I can make it opaque enough that I could say it without divulging. Your point is exactly right. I have someone who's in politics who did a poll of primary voters, asking them to rank 20 qualities that they are prioritizing as they vote in the primary. The number one quality was Christian. The number 20 quality was humility. and the number two quality was fighter. So Christian, fighter. Wow. Yeah, it's going beneath the camera. Humility. And that to me is one of the clearest pictures of our politics. Yeah. Right now.
They just want Carmen from 1987. They're like, if we could vote for Carmen, let's put Carmen.
That's right. Yeah.
With his sweet tan skin and curly hair. Okay, Michael, we know you have a million things to do and a million problems to solve. So we have kind of a speed round here at the end. Some of these are more frivolous and some are, but it, remember, this is like, we're not asking you to pontificate for millions of years. It's more just speed
Great.
Round
to
get your thoughts. Okay. So there's four of these. I'll do two, John will do two. What TV show, in your opinion, portrays politics most accurately? And we're talking of the West Wings, the Madam Secretaries, dare we say Veep, dare we say Parks and Rec?
Yeah, Madam Secretary, I think.
Really?
In terms of accuracy,
I
yeah.
I love that show.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay.
I love that
okay.
show.
All right, if everyone on Earth could read one of your, not one of your books, one of your articles, just one, what would it be? You've written a million of them, but is there one that sticks out? And then I'm going to read it aloud.
Right. you know, I wrote this piece I love for a publication called Mere Orthodoxy. I think the title of it is Food and the Life of the Nations, and it's the most personal thing I've ever written. Is about some of my family background, but also talking a bit about how food and identity work in our politics by talking about Italy a bit and this all has to circle back to Syria and Bologna. That would be an article.
And this is a timely question, that's which is actually punny once I actually read this, but if you had to redo I'm actually laughing thinking about this the age requirements for political office, what would you say the age parameters should be? I'm already laughing thinking about this. Have you seen anything get memed faster in your life?
Oh,
I don't know that I have. I just don't know that I have.
Oh gosh. You know, let's just only like 40 to 45. That's it. That's it. You know, like that's that's it.
That's great.
Yeah.
What is the minimum age? Is it 40 or is it 40 something?
So for president it's 35. I think for Senate,
35?
I think it's 28. I think.
Oh wow.
And so there aren't, and then, you know, like we have mayors in places in the country that are like 20. There's not an upper
40 to 45
age limit.
And you're out. It would be like, I feel like that you see it with Obama, you see it with, you know, the Bushes, any of the presidents, it is always mind boggling, especially over two terms when they do like the entry picture.
Yes.
And exit. It is like literally the weight of the world has just rested on the hair.
Yes.
It's just, you just see like, this is not someone who has won this victory.
I wasn't exactly like, the burden of my job in the White House wasn't, I wasn't sitting in the Situation Room, you know, making defense decisions. And even, you know, I was there from the time I was 20 to 23. And one of the big reasons I left was burnout. So like a burned out 23 year old, like that's a good, that's
your,
a good indication.
Litmus paper test. Yeah.
That is crazy. All right. Last question. If everyone listening, and in particular, Christians listening, let's just say hypothetically, everyone just forgot everything that we said over this past hour and 24 seconds, right? And now that you can say one phrase to them that they will retain, but only this one phrase. What would it be?
Yeah, the kind of people we are has much to do with the kind of politics that we have, and so that would be the phrase. And I would urge people to like think about that. You can't be responsible for how everybody else acts. Can't be responsible for what everybody else does. What you are responsible for, in cooperation with the Holy Spirit, is the kind of person that you're becoming.
Come on.
Wow.
Mikey Ware just laying the wood on the last of this. Okay, let me remind everybody before we release you, two books that you can go out there and read. Reclaiming Hope, Lessons Learned in the Obama White House about the Future of Faith in America, and his new book, which will be out in January, January 23rd, actually, exactly. It's called The Spirit of Our Politics, Spiritual Formation and the Renovation of Public Life. And then I think the appendices say something like, all the little things Dave doesn't understand. So you can go check that out at any point when that comes out. But thank you so much for being on, Michael.
This was great, man. Thank you.
It was great being with you. Thanks, guys.